You're listening to In the Drink with me, Joe Campanelli. When I'm not hosting In the Drink, you can find me at Fausto or our new wine bar, Lalu, both located in Brooklyn. On today's episode of In the Drink, we have Julia Negri, who makes wine in La Mora Barolo. I had a chance to visit Julia in May, and she has some of the highest altitude vineyards in Barolo. Combined with the terroir in the La Mora area, she makes some of the most elegant and beautiful wines in the region. And at only 29 years old, she's a fresh face who is really shaking things up in the area. Welcome to In the Drink. It's good to have you here.
Ciao, Joe. Thank you. Such a pleasure.
Can you tell me about your history in wine? You're so young and I feel like you've already accomplished so much. But if you tell us about how you got started.
The starting point. Still, we have a lot to accomplish. But then, yes, I've started a few years ago. But the property, I was quite lucky to have in the family this property that is some way is still on one side old and on one side new, because it's from my father's family since 200 years. And there used to be some vineyards, some hazelnuts, some grain, a lot of stuff in La Mora. We are in La Mora in the Barolo land. But then my grandfather, that was making completely other stuff in his life, so he was the Olivetti manager of the typewriting machine. This was quite known as company in Italy. He went on retreat in La Mora, in our estate, that was Serra Denari. And he took off all the vineyards in order to try to have some white truffle in an artificial way. So apart the forest that we own, he also tried to have it in an agricultural way. So he took off all the vineyards. And my father in 2001 replanted everything at the beginning with the idea to resell it. Then he found Serra Denari and he planted all the vineyards. So I had the chance to be in 2010 when I decided to start to make wine, to be able to, I had the asset to start, and my father was in the time on which he wanted to take off the Chardonnay and the Pinot Noir. So I think, okay, I will take these two vineyards. Then on the other side, I was also quite thinking about the market and to go around the world selling only Pinot Noir and Chardonnay from La Mora without having a Barolo could be a little bit of a problem. So I selected also a little parcel of Nebbiolo, and I've started with these three wines.
It's incredible to hear that your grandfather pulled up some of the vineyards in order to have this other project. I think in the history of Barolo, never...
another time, and also my family is not a countryside family. So who bought this estate were the Diatto family, that was the first family making the first car in Italy, and basically the Fiat then born by buying the Diatto company, and they were making the first F1 car. This is why we ride a little bit across the vineyards, because in the blood we have some Fast and Furious stuff.
I was practicing my F1 skills exactly. When we were driving on the tractor.
And so, you know, it was not, they were never followed the agricultural part. So it was also another period on which it was not a rich region, Barolo. Making wine was not really economically sustainable. Basically, my grandfather who bought it, he bought it. The legend in the family is that he bought it just to run away from the wife in the weekend. So this is the origin of Serra Denari. That's it. In this way, it's not really romantic. So for my grandfather, he was really, he also destroyed the two old Liberty's villa that were there in order to build this, what we call the bunker in the family, that it's more on the 70s really style of. So it's not like today. Like today, maybe if you have a big amount of money, you will invest it in the lands in Barolo back in times. You know, you were giving us a present, some Damigiane of Barolo, when you were buying 10 Damigiane of Dolcetto. It was.
And was your family based in Torino?
My father's family in Torino, my mother's family in Palermo. I grew up in Rome. Then
right
I
in the middle.
In Milano. Yes, in the, you know, it's the compromise between North and South in Italy. And then I studied in Milan and then I moved to La Mora. But my father still lives in Rome, my mother in Palermo. So.
And what was happening at the vineyards when your family was not there? Who was taking care of the vineyards and what were happening with the grapes? Were they being sold to a co-op or?
Before the 70s, yes. Then after, in 2001, my father started on making wine, so always followed by some consultants, so they were following. And he started on bottling, and he found Serra Denari, that was the name of the estate, before being recognized as the as an MGA, as a CRU, that it happens just in 2010, but it was the historical name of the deals, because Serra Denari literally means keep the money, and it's named like this because when there was the Black Plague, back in times, all the people living in the lower villages went to the top part looking for the fresher air and healthier one with the few money that they had. So they made all this work by keeping their money under the arms, and they went up to Serra Denari. That was the historical name of this hill. And then he found Serra Denari as a state, so he started on bottling and selling us Serra Denari. That was a winery.
Can you tell us the history of him wanting to sell the estate? When did he decide he wanted to sell it? And then when did he decide that he, instead of selling it, he was going to pass it on to you?
Well, you know, you have to imagine that he, when my grandfather died, my father was completely, it was a politician until the 89, who made quite a lot of reform in Italy, a journalist, historian, he made completely other stuff. And he never followed really La Marra. But what he used to say is that he went up there saying, okay, this is not my life. I will just replant it because they are telling me that the value of the ground, of the land definitely rise if I have some Nebbiolo for Barolo instead. And then he always told me that he has the land, when you are related with some land, it's very difficult, in fact, to separate yourself from your land. So at the end of the day, he was like, no, but I will not sell it because it's my land. It has always been an asset that in my life, also if I made completely other stuff, he always was in the background as a warranty for me. And so he decided to start. So this was how he came to this, but it was a quite long process.
It seems like he wanted to sell it, but he didn't realize he was getting connected to the land
exactly,
over the time.
Exactly like this. And then I admit he started on doing it also thinking about me. So I don't know, for instance, he called the house Villa Giulia without thinking it. And also last time, you know, we came back after a wedding and we were like, okay, thinking about how it evolves or the situation, etc. And let's say, okay, let's open the first vintage of this estate. Let's open a 2003. That was our first vintage. So we open it and, you know, I took the cork and there was written Giovanni and Giulia Negri on the cork. So also the first vintage was a little bit made thinking about Giulia is the one who will take it if one day she will want to do it.
And how old were you in 2003?
In 2003, I was 14. Wow. Yes. I think you have the picture on the back of the bottles that we were coming out from the vineyards, me and my father. Yes.
And were you thinking at that time, in the future, I would grow up and work?
No.
When did that happen?
No, because basically a little bit consider that my parents got divorced and they started on working together in the estate after the divorce. So for me, it was like, I will never enter in this cage of crazy. So it will never happen. For me, the wine was like almost a taboo. And then it happened that more, of course, on the other side, I grew up a little bit with wine. So it was something that maybe in an unconscious way was always there. And then I was the first time in Burgundy, not really, but the second time it was the first time on which I understood wine, how is it for what it is. So for what it rely a lot of different parts. And then I decided to start it and it was one way path, absolutely. And so I moved to La Marra from one day to another. And
tell me about that first trip to Burgundy. How did you plan it? Why did you go?
No, but I planned it, like it was really with one of my best friend who makes wine in Romagna. We were like, both of us, we had a little bit the same story. So some family who invested in wine, but was not really into wine. So a little bit different. And we had like there are a few days of holidays at the beginning of December in Italy, the 8th of December. So we said, okay, where are these 4 days? What are we doing? Let's go to Burgundy, but really like this. And then I don't know how to say, it seems like the classical dream or whatever, but with really quite a few liters of Pinot Noir after it. But then we visited a lot of producers, made a lot of friends and really understood terroir by terroir, it was the first time that we were really feeling our wine represent a terroir. And when the first time it happens, you are like, oh my God, wow, this is true. It's not only, you know.
And do you remember who were some of those early producers who inspired
you? The first wine that really inspired me, and it was in that visit, was Aurignon from Jubilard 2007. And it was the first one on which I said, really moved me something. When you have some emotions that arrive for one wine for the first time in your life, it's like, whoa. And so from this, I got, you know, like, this is wine, Julia, you have maybe to understand a little bit more and go deeper on that also, because if you want, you can do it. And so this is how it started.
And so when you got back home,
yeah,
what happened?
I fired myself from my job in Milan and I moved to La Morra and I've started.
Really? Yes. Just like that?
So then I've started. I was not knowing anyone in La Morra, in Piemonte, because my family is not living there. So I've started to work with few producers, knocking to all the cellar in order to try to taste a lot because I was not knowing. Then I made an harvest in South America with Ligia Belair. Always give me the contact because it was with Massoc, who is a winemaker in South America, with who they make the Aristos, which is their project in South America. And then I moved.
That's a Ligia Belair project in South America.
He has some wine that is made there. Then it is just few cuvées. Then the winery is another. The winemaker Massoc followed a different winery, and I was in one of these wineries. Then I travel quite a lot in all the wine region, and so, and it's still a work in progress. The thing that I really like about wine is that I think that any very big vigneron would never say that he already know. So you will always learn something. And so this is a little bit how it went.
What was the conversation like with your father when you got back and you said...
No, my father told me. It was quite scared because he knows me. Because me, I am someone who... When I decide to make something, I make it very deep. But when I have the sensation to obtain it, I get bored. So it was like, Julia, if this is another matter like this, what are you doing? Then on the other side, he was very happy about it. But at the beginning, he was quite scared. But then he told me, okay, I made it for you, in the sense, I made it for you. And this was a big pro. To do not have, you know, someone making the wine since a lot of time, because it allowed me to have a lot of freedom in making the wine. I do not have, you know, it has always been done like this. No, it doesn't exist. He just told me, boom, Julia, do it. So this has been a very big trust also from him. And also when he gave me the production responsibility in 2015, it has been a very good reward, you know, so, yeah.
How many years had you been working there and living in La Morra before he gave you the responsibility?
2 years.
And what was the first vintage of Giulia Negri where it stopped being Settendenari?
Before we were like two different estates.
Oh, okay. So they were existing at the same time.
Exactly. So when I started, there was Settendenari and Giulia Negri. Mia was doing just the Chardonnay and the Pinot Noir and one Barolo, while Settendenari was making the Lange Nebbiolo, the Barbera, and another two Barolo. Then at the end of the 2014, they gave me the production responsibility. So just the vineyards and the cellar, but the two winery were still existing. So I was making their wine in some way, but I was starting on taking care about the vineyards. And in 2015, I've started to make the harvest by parcelizing by soil. And when my father gave me the winery 2 years ago, I came out with the wine, how I parcelized in 2015 with the wine that we have now. So,
by parcelizing, do you mean that you harvest each parcel separately?
Definitely, yes.
Do you train them or tend them differently, or is it more just about the harvest?
No, it's just because they are completely different soil in different climates. So my soil starts from 530 meters and we go down until 400. And I have, for instance, from the bottom to the top part, 12 days in harvest of difference in the picking date. So it's quite a lot. So you really have different terroir. And by terroir, I mean not only the soil, but also the climate, the wind, the altitude, all the terroir expression. So they're really different kind of parcel up there, yes.
And what other changes did you make?
you know, the biggest change has been to have someone from the family who takes care about it. That is always different from someone from outside or a consultant that takes care about it. So when you have the passion in it, it's just that you start on following your own project and you make a lot of changement because it comes on the day by day, because every year I make a lot of changement up there, you know? So it was not something that I said, I came there up there and saying, no, we have to change everything. No, I've started by seeing how things were done. And then by working there, you say, okay, but maybe this could be done in this way. Maybe this could be done in this way. And I don't know, maybe in 5 years I will make stuff completely different from what I'm making actually today. So,
what have you done differently from your first vintages? What have you learned and what's been working well for you?
But it's a little bit also your experience that changed a lot.
There's so many thousands of minor decisions you make on an annual basis.
I think that make a great wine is a bigger question, mathematically speaking, with a lot of variances. And to make a great wine is a matter of details, small details. So it's by taking more and more attention to a lot of little stuff while working the wines, respecting more and more. And also is really that the wine is done by looking, smelling, tasting in the vinification. So it's not a receipt. So it's by following that was the big changement. And so it's what I'm taking care of more and more. For instance, my dream was a peristaltic pump until this year. And finally, I got a peristaltic pump that is definitely softer on the grapes. And this will be the first harvest in which I can work with it, or I don't know. I have a lot of stuff that I would like to change and I've changed from before on the working. So taking care about the oxygen on racking or cleaning everything as crazy or whatever. So these are, it's really on taking care about it.
This episode is brought to you by 750.com. 750 is the indispensable resource for the beverage industry. I use it every single day. You know, I'm currently researching for my new Italian wine book that I'm writing with Megan Krigbaum. And not only am I able to use 750 for all of my needs as a wine buyer at Falso and at Lalu, but sometimes I want to find out what grapes are grown in a certain region of Italy. And I'm able to just log in, check out Italian wine, and the raw material tab will show me all of the different grapes grown. I can select by red, rosé, white wine, sparkling, different size formats. It's a great way for me to find out what's going on, what people are growing, and what wines are available in my market. You know, I tasted the wines at your estate, and they're so delicious. I'm amazed that in such a short period of time you're able to make these beautiful wines. How did you learn how to make incredible wines like this?
I still have not. It's not me that make the wine. It's Serra Denari that come out with this wine. But then, by traveling really a lot, and maybe you know the fact that I was completely aware to do not know absolutely nothing, made me learning definitely faster, because I was thirsty of learning stuff. So I traveled a lot all around the wine region, and in every wine region, in every cellar, also, I don't know, also if you don't like the wine, you can learn how to handle in a better way a pump, how to manage this in a practical way, a more practical way, how you have to listen, tasting, in order to also create your own palate. The thing that helped me maybe the most is that I have in my mind since the beginning, then your palates change and your tastes change, but the kind of wine that I want to obtain there was definitely clear in my mind since the beginning, and it is still there. So when you have a very clear objective, it's then easier to arrive near to it in a shortest term, maybe, in a shorter term.
So are you able to put into words what that wine
great wine
is like?
No, it's hard.
Not what great then, wine is, but the wine that you had in your mind, the wine that you wanted to create, what that's like.
It's really elegance and power, it seems like it's common to say, but it must be something that enters really in a seductive way, in some way, that because it's on the fruit, it's always a grape that is speaking, but then you must have on the back or the ground all the soil from where it come from, so all the terroir expression must be in your palate and your nose all the time, but not in a rustic way. It must be very elegant. So it's hard to say by words, you know, then, you know, more or less.
Can you describe what it's like making wine in La Mora as opposed to some of the other crews, and especially with the altitude that you're at? I believe you're one of the highest altitude vineyards in the whole Barolo area.
Yes, among the, yes. Compared to the La Mora.
If someone were to taste a wine from La Mora versus the other crews, what would be a terroir indicator of La Mora? How would you know that something is from La Mora? And then,
but it's from the elegance. Respect to other Nebbiolo, Barolo coming from Serralunga or Monforte is definitely more on the finesse and feminine style of. Then in Serra Denari is a little bit more, it's higher, it's fresher, it's different. So maybe, you know, it was not a spot on which 30 years ago, when the average vintage was definitely cooler, so harder to get the right ripeness. It was not, maybe definitely difficult to have some Barolo up there or some Nebbiolo ripening. But today I have like the kind of sensation to be in the right place at the right moment with these vintages that are changing more and more. So at least for the wine that I want to do, that must be that fresh acid and in the elegance part, I think to be in the right place.
Are you at an altitude where 30 years ago it wasn't even acceptable for Barolo? Because from my understanding, maybe 10, 15 years ago, they increased the altitude that you can make Barolo at. I believe you're above that.
Yes. Yeah. As today, maybe being in the bottom side is quite tricky to manage. So it was absolutely like this.
And
it was a great spot for Dolcetto, Serra Denari, mm-hmm. for instance. It was really known for the Dolcetto variety. But
which is a grape that ripens earlier.
Definitely.
In a cooler climate, exactly. That's fine.
Exactly.
But so now that it's getting a little
now
bit warmer.
Now there is some Pinot Noir there in that vineyard. But that.
And what's the orientation of Serra Denari? Is it south? Is it
it's southeast? West.
It's west, okay.
See, it's like a kind of strange balance because it's, apart the soil that are also untypical from the La Mora part, because I have some also acid soil that are very untypical for the Barolo area in some spot. But then I have like, because I'm learning, I do not know Serra Denari, because without having some family making wine since generation and generation, I'm the first one, so I will discover it along my lifetime. The first hypothesis that I'm actually doing is that you have different, like, altitude. Maybe would not be very good if it was not west exposed. The west exposure is not very good because in general you take all the sun from the evening, but then if it's in altitude, you compensate it. So it's like if you have this kind of equilibrium a little bit with the acid soil also, because the acid soil in general give more vigorous to the vineyard are more vigorous than on average, so it's not always what you're looking for, but the altitude low it down the vigor. So it's like really a balance for the moment, now also that the vineyards are definitely older, a little bit, definitely not, but a little bit older. So we will see for the moment for what the results are. I'm quite
a hypothetical,
surprised.
Do you think that at your altitude with an east-facing vineyard, it could ripen for Barolo, or it's still that would be too cold at this point?
No, it would definitely can ripe for Barolo.
You can?
Yes,
yeah.
No. Vintage are warm today, yeah?
They're warm today.
Yes. It can definitely, also in a north-exposed part, I should not even say it, but Nebbiolo is coming quite good on the north-exposed. We use for the Lange Nebbiolo, but then.
It's incredible that the most famous vineyards that were named, you know, in the Renato Ratti times, you know, in the 60s and 70s when it was cooler, maybe now in the warm vintages, they might be a little bit too hot, a little bit too alcoholic.
Yes, also if the great terroir will always remain the great terroir. So I think that the greatest vineyard will remain greatest vineyard. It's just us as vigneron that we have to follow the path of the weather. So change a little bit. We will not maybe harvest no more so late, but a little bit before, taking care in order to have the phenolic ripeness in another way. But then the great spot will remain the great spot. So maybe some new one will come out as great spot, which is a little bit my challenge with Serra Denari, but the historical vineyard will remain I have any doubt about
that. Maybe one day the high altitude north facing crew world.
Could be. You will have something is changing. Yeah. A lot of people are looking more and more for some to buy some vineyard between 400 and 500 meters, not exposed, etc. But on the Grand Cru and the great vineyards.
One of the things that amazed me about your vineyard was how much forest and trees are still around. It's something that you don't see a lot in Barolo. A lot of times when you drive through Barolo, it's really a monoculture of only vines. Is your plan to keep some of the forest still there? And
I'm
what effect do you
trying
think?
To buy also some more forest because it's something that it will become, it's already definitely rare and it's a great asset to have it. So I have a huge biodiversity at mine. And it give you also to live there is definitely different than for living on the other side. And I have no neighbor. I'm alone in my, you know, piece of
in your bunker.
Heaven there. Then, you know, if you make some mistake, it's up to you. It's only you that make the mistake in treatment or whatever. It's also a different kind of viticulture because you have to deal with the forest. So apart the wild boar, you also have some other insects, but you do not have odor. So you have to learn a little bit how to handle the vineyards in the forest. But it's something that I want absolutely to preserve.
What effect do you think it has on the vines, having the forest so close by?
It depends on the different parcels that I have, because, as you know, we have different in altitude. So I have to handle in some way, maybe sometimes with a little bit more humidity on the highest, on the bottom part. But with the fact that I am all the rest of the vineyard very high, and with the fact that I do not have absolutely nothing between me and the mountains, the fact too I have the forest do not affect in closing the vineyards, but it just maybe sometimes defends a little bit also from the wind. But I do not have the bad side effect of having a forest in the vineyards in a part on which you do not have the wind, you know, so it's really... It's strange, Radinari, because it's like you're really in a mountain. It's like a mountain.
It doesn't feel like Barolo. It's amazing.
Yes, you're more in a... It's more wild.
So you have this great Nebbiolo, but also these international grapes of Chardonnay and Pinot Noir. How do you approach them differently or the same versus the Pinot?
No, completely different.
Completely different.
See, no, there are three characters completely different. When you vinify Pinot versus Nebbiolo... You're speaking to two completely different persons. So the Pinot Noir is very delicate, and one mistake is already in the glass immediately. Where the Nebbiolo look at you from the top part and say like you are completely useless to me, and you just have to to take care a little bit. But he has another personality completely. So no, I was at the beginning. The Pinot Nero was approached a little bit more with the like the Nebbiolo. But then it was completely wrong. Absolutely not there. Two words.
I found that when tasting your Pinot Noir and Chardonnay, you don't taste the oak, even though you're using some small barrique. Mm-hmm. So often when I taste a nice Pinot Noir Chardonnay from Italy, there's an oak characteristic to it. Is that intentional for you to not have that oaky flavor, or is it...
I'm quite sick about the wood, so... I make and made back in times a lot of research on it. And for instance, the Chardonnay, that is actually 100% new wood because I'm creating the wood park in some way. So I had to start from some way. I have the chance to have one of my best friends work in the wood world. And she passed me a lot of books on that. So I'm studying quite a lot how the wood can be integrated with the wines, and also respecting what are you looking for one wine, which kind of wood can fit the best. So if you want some tension, these are the forests. If you want some fruit, more fruit, that it underlines more the fruit, this kind of forest, etc. So I think it's the result also of a lot of time spent on tasting and traveling around Tonnellerie a little bit all over the world. Yeah, one also in Chile, but then mostly in France and Austria. And I'm quite happy about the result that I had on the wood integration in both the wines, more on the Chardonnay than the Pinot actually, but then on the Pinot we are working on it.
Something you said before was that You visited a lot of wineries also in Piemonte. It's, mm-hmm. it's my understanding that it's not very common for a producer to visit another producer in Piemonte. Do you agree with that? And how are you received when you go and you say, you know, I make wine all the way up on the hill up there?
It depends on the winemakers. Yes. They're not really open to do it, but you have a lot of that taste together, or at least you have to make it as a possibility, and then everyone wanted to taste the other wine. So, and at the beginning, you know, they were looking at me a little bit as, what is this strange animal that is around La Marra that comes from the city, and what is she doing? But then after that, they saw me how I work also in the field and in the different cellars, and I went to a few of them, I don't know, pruning with them or helping in the cellar, etc. They took me a little bit under their wing. Exactly. See. And so at the end of the day, they actually today help me quite a lot when I need it. And I got some respect from also among the oldest winemaker. So.
Oh, wow. What is the relationship with your father now? Is he involved in the winery?
Yes, it is. We are partners also. So he is helping me all the time that I'm traveling. He come up. So he is there and is a good hand, definitely. We are a team. Sometimes we fight a lot, but we fight. We have the same goal. And we recognize both of us, which is which are the strength and the weakness of one from the other. So, yeah, we are becoming more and more definitely a very good team. And so, no, it's very cooperative.
Would you say the style of Serra Denari and Giulia Negri are different? Serra Denari, also, does Serra Denari exist anymore, or it's no longer existing?
No, now it's all merged.
It's so all merged.
They still exist, but they do not, both of them. So,
does the style of the old label differ from what you're doing now, or is it just sort of a continuation?
From what I was doing before?
Yeah, from... Yeah.
It's the evolution.
The evolution.
Yes. See, it's not something that was made to be, you know, completely different from what it is, just what came out from the story.
Yeah, I noticed on this last trip a lot more growth between the vines, a lot more green than on my...
The jungle.
Yes, both at your winery, but in Barolo in general, yes. A lot more people are keeping more growth between the vines. I assume that is an indication of less herbicides and more organic, biological sort of winemaking in the area. Do you think that's true? Like, is that something that you think about as well for your own winery?
I'm missing some of a lot that we are doing it. So then it's not only in the organic way, but it's also in all the biodiversity. This is why I'm keeping a lot attention to the forest. It's a very good, positive way, because it also means, you know, it's also the result of a region that is becoming more and more able to invest something in the viticulture, because also the herbicide, they are very bad, but you can easily understand that 25, 30 years ago, maybe the vigneron was not so rich in order to have people working all the time with all the greens, because it means a lot of work more. So it's all current with the growth of the region. Then we still have a lot of work to do. It's not really that we have to stop with the organic way. The organic way is not the solution to solve of the problem about having a sustainable viticulture. It's just a starting point. We have to find other solutions to avoid all this copper. So it's, in order to pay attention, we have to invest money as viticulture. So it's the starting point, I hope, to find the right solution, the really sustainable solution that nowadays is still not the organic way. But we are more and more working in this way.
A lot of winemakers I respect are concerned about copper and the effects of copper.
It is, because I'm now at the last year of conversion on being organic, because I was working in this way, so I said, why not to do not take the certification? But I must say that like last year in 2018, we made an amount of treatment that was crazy, and we were at the limit of kilo that you can do per hectare of copper. And you were thinking, this is not sustainable, by the way. you have a lot of solution that maybe you have some psychotropic products that are products that are not really biological, they are not natural, they are chemical, but they do not have any residuals in the vineyard, any residuals in the soil, that they could avoid like 10 treatments, maybe not 10, I'm exaggerating, okay, maybe a little bit less, 5 treatments later in the season. But 5 treatments means 5 times more the tractor in the fields, so you're compacting definitely more the soils, the CO2 that the tractor has, the oil that the tractor uses. So I don't know which is the more sustainable in this sense, and the copper that you put in the soil. No, it's tricky. So we do not have to be too ideological with stuff and just being wise and understand that there is not one way to work, but it depends from a lot of variances.
From my math, you're 29 years old or so. Mm-hmm. Are there other winemakers in Barolo who are in their 20s? Or what's it like being such a young winemaker?
I have a lot of daughters and son that are in my age, absolutely, and they take care and they run the winery, definitely. There are a lot of women, really, quite a lot. Yeah, I think about, apart the Rinaldi, Chiara Boschi, but also the three sisters, Grasso from Barbaresco, Cadelbaio, that she are three, and they manage everything. One is in the cellar, the other is in, they are very strong, and then, we are quite a lot, so. No, it's a kind of taboo, this fact that to think that it's hard if you are young. No. I do not find it.
It's exciting. Like, I think it's very exciting to see a new, fresh face in the area. Someone doing something new. I know it's a continuation of Serra Denari, but you have your name on this new estate. It's for me, as a Barolo lover, where it seems like things move slowly in the region. Mm-hmm. I feel like you're shaking things up.
I'm boosting a little bit.
Yeah, I think it's very exciting.
Piedmont is calm. No.
It's very exciting. And you're making beautiful wines. Mm. And I'm so excited that they're going to be here in New York.
Yes. Let's see if I will come back after this week. But it's always amazing to be here.
I think as long as you and I don't go into a car where I'm driving, you'll be fine. You'll be back in New York.
Yes, exactly. Let's see.
Thank you so much. This has been such a great conversation.
Thank you, Joe.
I really appreciate it.
It was a pleasure.
That's it for this episode of In the Drink. Julia Negri's wines are new to the market. They're being imported by Kermit Lynch, who I want to thank for their help with this episode, and also Ryan Looper of T. Edward Wines, who's their distributor here in New York. I also want to thank our really talented producer, Jasmine Molly, and Renny Lopez for the theme music. Please remember to rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts. Follow me on Instagram at Joe Campanelli, and you can always email me if you have any questions or suggestions at inthedrinkpod@gmail.com. Thanks so much for listening. Catch us next week.